At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise, and with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
And we're back. I love that kind of thought and stuff. So here's a great one, and one that might be a great conversation because it's fresh off the press. Can children get the COVID-19 vaccine?
Yes.
Okay. The answer here is not yet.
Salam alaikum, everyone.
What starts here changes the world. Well, I've got to admit, I kind of like it. What starts here changes the world.
We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
The average American will meet 10,000 people in their lifetime.
I was handcuffed to another man from another tribe whose language I did not speak.
Don't think, feel.
But if every one of you changed the lives of just 10 people, and each one of those people changed the lives of another 10 people, and another 10.
We did not know each other, and we could not speak to each other, because if we could have spoken to each other, we might have been able to figure out what was happening to us.
To every politician who was taking donations from the NRA,
name on you.
I believed them when they said they were sleeping on concrete floors. I believed them. Children being separated from their parents in front of an American flag. I believe them.
And you can change the entire population of the world, 8 billion people.
And if we could have figured out what was happening to us, we might have been able to prevent it.
If you think it's hard to change the lives of 10 people, change their lives forever.
Well, it didn't happen. Here we are.
I believe these women.
You're wrong.
I feel extremely lucky to be here with all of you fighting for justice, for equality, for the right for us to equally exist in this country.
There were 329 uprisings, 157 cities within 4.5 years. And neither Martin nor Fannie had any control over that.
We might be headed to the promised land of speaking the truth and finding our external liberty once we internally liberate ourselves.
But their children were saved, and their children's children. Generations were saved by one decision, one person. But changing the world can happen anywhere, and anyone can do it. So what starts here can indeed change the world. But the question is, what will the world look like after you change it?
Welcome to Public Access America.
Make a stand. I know I did. Thank you very much. And may God bless America. May God bless America.
Yeah. I think the expectation is that this week the FDA is going to extend its emergency use authorization for the Pfizer vaccine for children ages 12 to 15 because they have been doing ongoing clinical trials. We'll see how that goes. I'm not sure about Moderna. I need to double check. I don't want to say
Moderna's said that they're looking to get their EUA towards the end of the month.
Okay, yeah. So it looks like it's going to happen as well. That's good.
Yeah, right. They're so like what I was seeing, and this actually is a very interesting topic of discussion because this is something that Debbie and I had spoken about, but this is something that I definitely want to have bring you in on this one, Dan. So Pfizer's data shows that what they're reporting is 100% efficacy in children 12 through 15. Moderna's data, what they said is that it's 96% effective from ages 12 to 17, because the caveat there, Pfizer tested down to age 16 with their initial emergency use authorization. Moderna did to 18, so they didn't have the 17 and 16 range that they lumped into this particular range. So the question, because mathematically speaking, nothing is 100% effective. So Dan, can you talk to us about why Pfizer might say that their vaccine is 100% effective, and what does that actually mean?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. That's the heart of vaccination, right? So,
right.
First of all, when you're talking about there's efficacy and effectiveness. Efficacy is a measure of how well the vaccine did in a clinical trial under carefully designed and tested conditions. Effectiveness is the same set of calculations, except just done in like a larger general populace. So efficacy is what is calculated in order to get authorization or approval. Effectiveness is what is calculated after the vaccine's been distributed for a while. And it's kind of joking, like not jokingly, but euphemistically called like a phase four trial, like after the vaccine's been distributed. So the definition of, say, vaccine efficacy is comparing the rates at which a disease occurs after vaccination among those who are vaccinated versus those who are not vaccinated. So Pfizer can say 100% efficacious against COVID because that means that of the people who were vaccinated in that trial, zero got the condition that they were looking for. Like, so in this case, it might have been symptomatic COVID, like you actually feel ill and test positive, right? If you have zero people in who got the vaccine and then over the course of the trial then got symptomatic COVID, then that is 100% effective, or 100% efficacious, excuse me, for the vaccine. But whenever you expand out from the efficacy of a clinical trial to the effectiveness of just the general population, inevitably, you're going to see the effectiveness numbers drop a little bit compared to the efficacy numbers. So, for example, vaccine efficacy for the Pfizer vaccine in the first initial EUA was, I think, like 92 or 93%. Again, double check on me. But then the studies of the effectiveness in different populations have shown it to be like 85 to 90% effective. Because when you increase your sample size, when you increase the number of people who are kind of measured in the experiment, you're going to have a higher likelihood of catching a couple of people who do still get COVID or do still have some kind of condition, right, as well. So those numbers are going to drop. So a lot of it is a function of how large your group is. But you can say 100% efficacious, but you don't just say it's 100% effective. It's 100% efficacious in the group of participants that were studied for the purpose of this trial. Right. And so that's always important to think about. Again, epidemiology is the science of denominators. What is your denominator? How many people were in this trial? Of the people in this trial, 100% efficacious. Of the people in the world, you know, a couple hundred million who probably will get the Pfizer vaccine by the end of this year, you know, what is the effectiveness when you compare it among the couple hundred million people who did or did not get vaccinated? Very different denominators. You're going to expect some variability between those numbers. Does that answer your question, Jeffrey?
Yes, that is exactly what I was going to go with. Like, for me, like as a data person, when I see that something is 100%, you know, that immediately makes me question, what did their sample look like? Because, and how did they structure their sample? Because nothing is ever 100% effective. So immediately to me, there are questions of, you know, did they cherry pick potentially different things in order to make it more effective or efficacious, I should say, versus, you know, like with Moderna, they had 96% efficacy. So to me that, you know, it looks a little bit more realistic in that, you know, it's closer to what their numbers were. The initial numbers for Pfizer and Moderna were 95 and 94.1% efficacious. In the real world, looks like both of them dropped down to about 90%, at least when I was reading the Israeli study on Pfizer, that it dropped down to 90%. The U.S. Healthcare providers, both for Pfizer and Moderna, that dropped down to 90%. And I'm sure that as we get more data, that's going to change even more, because one of the other things we have to keep in mind is the fact that there are now variants that are out there that, you know, while the vaccine does provide, you know, still significant protection, those variants are still able to break through, and breakthrough cases is something that's coming up. Yeah, so before we go on to breakthrough cases, though, they weren't
tested in the original trials. That's
exactly
thing. Exactly. But that's all. There have been additional studies of vaccine effectiveness against some of these variants, and there was a study I think that just came out last week that showed that the Pfizer vaccine was very effective against the B.1.1.7 variant. So there's another thing to keep in mind is that when you talk about effective versus efficacious, like to Jeffrey's point, like what are you actually studying? Right. There are four metrics that are being talked about for vaccine efficacy for COVID. The first is asymptomatic infection, as in, is the virus going to be able to get into your body and you test positive? Sorry, asymptomatic or any infection of any kind, right? Symptomatic or asymptomatic, right?
Okay.
If you test, what is your likelihood of testing positive if you got the vaccine relative to your odds of testing positive without getting the vaccine? That's the first one. The second one is symptomatic COVID, right? Some people test positive for COVID and don't have any symptoms. Mm. A lot of people do get symptoms. If you're only looking to see test positive and are sick, then that's your effectiveness numbers are probably going to be higher because you're deliberately excluding people who tested positive and not feeling symptoms, right? So that's one way to go from you might be 90% effective against asymptomatic COVID, but then you might be 95% effective against symptomatic COVID because you're excluding the positive tests with no symptoms. Then there's hospitalizations or severe COVID, and then there's deaths, right? So COVID infection of any kind, COVID with symptoms, severe COVID with hospitalization, or COVID resulting in death, right? Those are the four metrics that are being studied for every vaccine trial, right? So most of the time when people talk about vaccine efficacy or effectiveness, the number that they're throwing around is symptomatic COVID infection. And that's because the clinical trials for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines were based on that, right? When they got the emergency authorization, it was not based on data of whether or not folks tested positive or not. It was whether or not they were sick and then tested positive. Gotcha. So that's something to keep in mind about, when you're talking about how data are presented, like Jeffrey is making a fantastic point about that. Those are the four metrics you should be looking at every study. And what we found, fortunately, is that these vaccines are very effective against people getting sick from COVID, but they're also very effective against people just testing positive at all. So, being an asymptomatic carrier. So important to have that distinction and keep that in mind, that you're not just looking at COVID, no COVID, how you define COVID is there are semantics in there.
But the very sick, the reoccurring, that was a happy thing to discover, that we might not actually be able to get the disease again. What I want to say is it's kind of like efficacy is like Michael Jordan throwing free throws in practice, and hitting 100% of his three free throws. And then the other one is more of the general public with all free throws. And what we're saying is nobody's dying from throwing a free throw, but they are missing from time to time.
Yeah. Right. Or Michael Jordan doing, or any basketball player shooting three free throws in practice versus in a game, it's a really good analogy. It's like when you introduce other stuff that was not included in a carefully designed trial, there's going to be stuff that makes things less perfect, and that's okay. That's to be expected. What we don't want is efficacy to be 90% and effectiveness to be 20.
Right. We don't want Michael Jordan falling on the floor having a heart attack after he throws a free throw.
And exactly.
What we're saying is that hasn't happened yet. In fact, he didn't even have to go to the hospital. He never even got sick enough to stop throwing three throws.
Exactly.
So, do you think that if I've already had COVID, do you think I should get the vaccine now?
Yes. Yes, we're encouraging everyone to get the vaccine regardless of whether or not you've had COVID. And the reason is how do I phrase this? We know how much, COVID immunity, roughly speaking, is delivered into someone's body with the vaccine, right? They're very standardized dosages. We know the concentrations of the proteins, the spike proteins that are getting into people when you get the vaccine. And we know that on the whole, that level is a lot higher than a lot of people who get a minor disease or minor symptomatic infection.
Right.
So when you have a stronger introduction of, antigen into your body, you have a stronger memory built against it. And we kind of know that that's really stable. A lot of people who have asymptomatic COVID or mildly symptomatic COVID might not get all that much virus into their body And mm-hmm. so because of that, there's not as much exposure to the immune system to build memory, and we don't really know how long that immunity can last. That's there is some evidence, like the CDC guidance is looking out 90 days. Like having, we know there's some short-term immunity to reinfection of COVID with most of the time 90 days or more. Some data suggests that it could be up to 6 or 7 months, if not more. But again, that's also limited by the fact that COVID's not been around for that long. Right. But we are confident that, you know, COVID vaccination, because there's a lot more antigen introduced into the body than a lot of, you know, minor infections, most people are going to be more immune from getting the vaccine than whether or not they got COVID. And in fact, there are some data that have come out to suggest that, right? People who've gotten COVID without getting vaccinated versus people who've gotten COVID and gotten vaccinated one or two doses versus people who didn't get COVID mm-hmm. and got vaccinated, right? And what we see is people who had COVID on the whole have lower levels of antibodies than people who got any vaccination of any kind on the whole. We have those data. Those have been published. So nice. We have the proof that that works. And that's why you say, like, COVID plus vaccine is more protective than just getting the vaccine. That's another thing too. So right. if you want more immunity, get the vaccine, even if you've gotten COVID.
And I can speak to the mathematics of this too, because I was actually studying the math on this one. So when they looked at the study, and so there's a lovely set of box grams and histogram charts about what that immune system response looks like. So, you know, they actually broke it down quite nicely, so that way you could see what it looked like. So there was immunity to the immunity that people that had COVID would have later was actually pretty scattered all over the place. So right. it was up and down. It was, you know, there was a certain level of immunity to have that you would have, but it would be less predictable. Then there was the immunity that you had after you got one shot of one of the COVID vaccines. And so it was a bit more predictable how much immunity you would have, but it was still all over the place. Then you had COVID plus the one shot of one of the vaccines. And that actually got even tighter in terms of the response that they were seeing, but it was higher. So there was more there. What they were seeing is that there were more neutralizing antibodies and more markers there that would say that a person would have an expected response. But the highest yet was when you had two doses of the vaccine, that grouping became even tighter yet and even larger. Right. So with that, you know, what we're seeing mathematically speaking is that between not getting the vaccine, getting COVID plus one shot, or getting two shots of the vaccine, the ability to predict your body's immunoresponse to it, mathematically speaking, is that when you get two shots, you're going to have a much more predictable immune response, in that you're going to have more antibodies, statistically speaking, and that response is going to be far more predictable than just leaving it to natural chance, or even just having had the virus and then getting the shot.
Yeah. That's a fantastic description, Jeffrey. You nailed it. I took the liberty of, I know we're recording by Zoom, I just dropped the link to the article that Jeffrey and I were referring to. It's in the chat. So, ooh, nice. Jason, if you wanted to share that with the followers, that's mm-hmm. something that some of the text is kind of dense and really jargon filled, but you can really see there's a wonderful graph that shows exactly what Jeffrey's talking about, and folks who don't have a really strong science background can really see the difference of, like, it's very well designed. It's a very simple and effective graph. So I think that's a really powerful message to show. So that link is for people to share.
Okay. I just want to say that, like, if everybody gets the vaccine in a 2 month span, we know when it starts to run out. But if half of us get the vaccine in the 2 month period, but others of us got the virus 6 months earlier, then the length of immunity varies, and some people, it's harder to quash the virus when it has somewhere to go. But if we all get it at once, then there's nowhere for the virus to go for the amount of time that we're all immune at the same time. And I think that's a big deal. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So Dan, now yeah. I got one for you. This one's going to be a fun one. So one of the best pieces of news that I've seen here coming up is that, you know, Moderna is already testing and tooling up one of their variant boosters. And they're showing that there is a statistically significant response in the immune system, and that it looks to be effective against the Brazil and South African variants. That's Moderna's testing that one out right now. When it comes to boosters, are we going to see similar trials based on, you know, how we're seeing the COVID vaccine now? Or when it comes to boosters, do you have to go through that process all over again in order to get that approval, in order for a booster to be used?
Yes. My understanding, again, if folks have better information than this, they can always, you know, fact check me. But my understanding is, yes, for a booster shot, it's just the same as, you know, going through a whole additional, you know, series of trials, because you need to show that that booster shot is safe and effective, right? So if the booster shot does not actually substantially improve immunity, then it might not get authorized or approved. So it's going to be important for Moderna and for Pfizer, who are doing something similar, to show that a booster shot is not only safe, but it actually is effective. Because if you start giving everyone booster shots and they really don't substantially improve people's immunity, then there's no point in having a mass campaign to get spending hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, to get the vaccine distributed to folks. So it's going to be important for them to go through the same process, to show the data, to submit it to the FDA for their review, and to get either EUA or approval for this booster dose. But I'm optimistic to see that, and I really do want to see some of the raw data myself. That'd be exciting.
Yeah, it would.
This kind of stuff is actually exciting to me, because, like, you know, that's, I think, one of the biggest things that we've all been concerned about, at least in the scientific community, is that what does it take to get a booster tooled up with these new mRNA systems from Pfizer and Moderna. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, I, you know, because we've always had this, you know, issue of lagging behind new variants of a disease that come up, the ability for these companies to tool up new boosters is going to be very important, because as we're seeing in India right now, there is a huge problem. And if you think that this is only something that could happen to India, they only crossed our threshold for deaths for the first time. Like, we had it bad for a while, and India's finally hit the death threshold that we have. But in terms of cases, I mean, it's astronomical.
And the lack of infrastructure is terrible. I like to think that India is what we would have been if Donald Trump had been reelected.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to say my heart goes out to India, but it really is a very difficult situation. And one thing that's been particularly alarming for me is to look at not just the case numbers, but the positivity rate, right? So when you do testing, what we've been monitoring for, and there's been a lot of policies, especially in Pennsylvania where I live, a lot of policies have been implemented based not only on number of cases, but on positivity rate, because the rate of tests that you're doing that are positive is a kind of a barometer, if you will, for the percentage of true COVID cases you're actually capturing. So we were trying to, like, have enough COVID testing so that, you know, positive test rates are 5% or lower. The most recent numbers out of India and their most recent surge, with the cases going super, super high, they're above our threshold for COVID cases, and their positivity rate is over 20% and is rising. So it's not just that the numbers of cases are rising, it's that the percent of positive cases is going up, which means there are, for every case that we're identifying by testing, there are a bunch more that we're not. Right. So the true number, the true burden of COVID that's hitting India is a lot higher than what we're even measuring. And that's really concerning.
And they do four times the population size of us. Speaking of denominators.
Yeah, they do. And it's also, like, because there's a lot of rural areas in India where, you know, that, you know, vital statistics like mortality and births and deaths are not very effectively calculated because of lack of infrastructure. There are a lot of people dying that we're just not catching. You know, so again, the death numbers are probably a lot higher, because the positivity rate is that barometer for how severe the disease is and how much we're not catching. So it is really concerning. And for a frame of reference, the moving average positivity rate, in at least in my county in Pennsylvania, at the very peak of the pandemic, never really reached above, I think, 15-18%. In the darkest parts of the most brutal days of the winter, when we were really, you know, in the shit, and they're already skyrocketing past 20% in India, and it's only going up.
Wow.
So it's really, really serious. So yes, booster shots, additional development, but to the point about booster development, That's one of the beautiful things about the development of these mRNA vaccines, right? Developing a vaccine that is like a live attenuated or killed virus,
right,
is a lot harder to do than with this mRNA. Like you can synthesize mRNA pretty easily. It's a very well established thing to do. So you just mm-hmm. need to get the sequence. You do the sequencing. And you're like, okay, this is the sequence. So in theory, you know, a really good vaccine could be developed, a vaccine that you know is designed to, you know, boost immunity against a variant can be designed very quickly, matter of days can be designed. Then it's like the testing and clinical trials and everything. So we do have the capacity as a scientific community to develop immune boosters or booster vaccines for variants very quickly. It's just the question is, you know, are there going to be consequences? Is the side effects going to be bad, or, you know, mm-hmm. worries about immunity and everything, or worries about anaphylaxis or side effects and everything. So sure. I'm optimistic that with the mRNA platform is very well designed to respond to variants. It's just a question of will it actually work in practice? Because the theory is great.
Sure. But I mean, it's no more dangerous than a peanut to some people at this point. It might hurt some people. It might not hurt some other people. That doesn't mean we all should not eat a peanut.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that's one of the things about, like, you know, in speaking to Dan's point, you know, this is technology that was pretty much theoretical about 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. So the fact of the matter is that, you know, we had a pretty good idea that we could do this, but we just weren't quite there yet.
Right.
And so, like, our understanding of what all, you know, our understanding of what all the potential side effects were going to be were very limited at the time. And now that we've had, you know, tests done, and then we've had a broader use by the population. And, you know, really this stuff has only been available to the public for about 6 months now. And in the beginning, very limited availability to the public. It's only now that we're starting to see broader availability. So from a data perspective, it's only going to be in the next few months that we're going to have a much broader understanding data-wise what we're even looking at. And yeah. that is going to go into the consideration of what could happen with the booster shots. You know, that's, you know, two of the biggest enemies that we have in terms of math are time and data. Mm. Because you have to have both. And the reality is that if you haven't had something out for a very long period of time, the reality is that you're not going to have a lot of data. You could have something out for a long period of time and have little data because of lack of adoption. But
right.
in like these beginning stages where it's more about the availability, like we had very limited availability, but now as we're getting broader availability, now time is our enemy and our friend.
Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, you don't know what data sets are important and what aren't. Are either one of you confident in the data that was collected over the first year of this?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the biggest data science projects in the history of civilization.
Okay.
I mean, we have the whole concept of having a live updating system where people log their side effects of the vaccine into a national database that can be mined very quickly. And in the matter of like less than 10 days for scientists to be able to review that, notice an alarming trend with the Johnson & Johnson with this really severe blood clotting disease mm-hmm. and be able to pause that. The fact that was able to happen is an absolute marvel of modern science and an absolute marvel of the collaboration that's gone into it. So I'm very confident in it. And that's the thing, like we have more data about this vaccine than any vaccine developed in history or these vaccine platforms.
Okay.
So I'm very optimistic to see the future of this. And it has been really wonderful to see a lot of communities come together to make this happen. I know we're concerned about vaccine hesitancy. I know there's concerns about variants, but we have definitely proven to the universe that we can respond to global crises very effectively if we put our minds to it. So I'm very optimistic. What do you think, Jeffrey?
From a data standpoint, I absolutely am confident in the data. I think, you know, once again, going back to our biggest enemy was time and data availability. Like even if we don't talk about the COVID vaccine in general, but even just, you know, data surrounding COVID itself, you know, you don't, like, there's probably a bunch of data out there that we don't have simply because we didn't know what we were looking for in the beginning.
Right.
And that's one of those that's unfortunately just the curse of any type of scientific revelation is that if you don't know that you should be looking for something, you're not looking for it until suddenly something is just blaring in your face. And it's like, okay, I need to look at this. I need to study this. And then from there, it's about having the availability to be able to study and test it. You know, when you look at just how we were able to test for and identify COVID, even in the early days of the virus itself, testing was very limited and it wasn't very effective. Now, the efficacy, the effectiveness of testing for the virus is a little bit better than it was, probably not as great as we would like it to be, but the data that we're getting is now is far better than what it was in the beginning. And then from there, now being able to collect, log, and analyze data, you know, like to Dan's point, where now we're able to look and see, you know, what that spread looks like, what that positivity rate looks like. It is allowing us to, instead of using a sledgehammer on a finishing nail, you know, now we can use just a little, you know, just the right sized hammer to get this done, as long as we have community participation. In terms of the data that we're getting in, from the vaccine itself, this is one of those things where there inherently there's always going to be issues with self-reported data, and this is where it gets tough. With COVID, you know, and people reporting symptoms and going and getting tested, you have a discrepancy between people who, you know, once they figure out that they have COVID, then there's the question of, well, why should I go and get tested? All of these symptoms match up. I probably have COVID. What's the point in getting tested? Well, the point in getting tested for COVID is to positively identify the case, so that way you can notify others of what might be happening. And that allows you to stop community spread. So when it comes to being able to mathematically look at it, the more data that you have, the better you are at initiating policies that protect public health. Right. It allows you to be able to address things within your community before it becomes a statewide problem or a national problem. Same holds true with the vaccine, like with Johnson & Johnson. You know, you've got a lot of people that are entering information. Now, the issue there is that, once again, self-reporting always has its issues. What do I notice that is different since I've gotten the vaccine versus what do I notice that, you know, what do I want to report?
Right.
You know, for example, When you do a bunch of stupid stuff, you hurt all of the time. So the question becomes is, does the pain that I'm feeling today, is that more because of, you know, the vaccine that I took? Or is it just, you know, the weather's changing and my shoulder's fucking shot? You know, because that's a reality for me too. And and unfortunately, without really when it comes to the individual and not being monitored by a medical professional, there's only so much data that you know is going to be good. Now, for example, like where I had difficulty breathing, that clearly, you know, from what I could tell, it felt like what it was like when I was sick. And I did not have any problems like that in the many months leading up to when I got that shot. Mm. Even after I got the first shot, I did not have those issues. So when I got that second shot, I made sure to note that, because that's something that happened to me that, number one, I felt when I was sick, but hadn't felt in the year plus since I'd been sick, and didn't feel after the first dose of the vaccine. Self-reporting is always going to have some problems, but when you have medical professionals that get involved, that's when you start to get a little bit more objective data rather than subjective data. And so that's one of those things that we're always going to be up against, because subjectively, I always hurt, and depending on my mindset, yeah, it's the vaccine. No, it's not the vaccine. But if I'm in the hospital with a side effect, the doctor is going to be like, yeah, that kind of looks like it's most likely an effect from the vaccine itself.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because you're just trying, you're on a website trying to come up with something, right? And that's different than somebody saying that's a something. And just really quickly, if you are diagnosed with COVID-19, you can get the vaccine, you can get the first dose. You have to finish your isolation period of 10 days and then have 24 hours of lack of symptoms before you get your second dose. But that was basically,
we don't want anybody with symptoms or with who have COVID to go get the vaccine. So just make sure that if you do test positive, you're out of isolation, but there's no requirement, as Jason was saying, there's no requirement that you have to wait after your COVID recovery. Just recover and get out of isolation first. Right. And that's mainly to protect, well, first of all, we don't want people getting a bunch of antigen when they're trying to recover from a disease. That's also a way to protect the healthcare providers and other people going to the vaccine clinic, right? Don't go with COVID because you might expose and get others sick.
Beautiful. So that's all the real questions I had. I have a personal question, and that is, I have macular degeneration, which is a form of an autoimmune disease. My immune system attacked my eyes, causing swelling. I got the vaccine and I had no symptoms. Do you think I should be reporting that somewhere?
You should. I would strongly encourage anybody who gets the vaccine to be actively reporting how they're feeling and everything to VSafe or to the system that you can get when you register or when you get a vaccine. Sign up for that. And if you say you're feeling good, all the more reason for us to know if you're feeling good. You should log it still.
I love that.
To Jeffrey's credit, is like, if you know what's going on, still log it, because then we can get the right denominators, right? A bunch of people if the people who are reporting issues are over, like, biased towards people who are only reporting those issues,
right?
And the people who are saying, I'm fine, so I'm not going to bother, that's going to make it look like situations are much more severe than they actually are. So be part of the experiment. Log the fact that you're doing well. Log the fact that you're feeling fine so that we have accurate data to be able to make correct assessments for the public.
That's beautiful. I want that.
And that was the beautiful thing about, like, that VSafe program is that you know, it gave me the opportunity to log what I was feeling and how it was affecting me. So that way, you know, when this data gets analyzed later by the FDA, they're going to be able to sit down and say, okay, people who got the vaccine, yeah, it looks like pretty commonly getting some site pain, you know, that was definitely a thing. Okay. We can say that's the thing, but now we can look at what that pain threshold looked like. Mild. Okay. Yeah. Anybody who's ever gotten a tetanus shot knows that getting a shot in the arm sucks.
Yeah.
But when it starts to be like, okay, now it's affecting me and how I am in the day, it gives doctors later who are going to be giving out these shots a little bit more information to say, hey, you know, if you have a certain set of markers, you might run into some issues where you might want to plan for a day off to give yourself some time to recover.
Yeah.
If you can, or plan to get a shot on a day when you know you're going to have a day off, because that's one of the things that we're going to have to keep in mind is not everybody gets a paid day off in order to be able to recover from anything. Yeah. You know, that's just the reality of it. So being able to get the best information you can and pass it off to those who need it is going to be really important.
Yeah.
But then even too, things that aren't listed in the VSafe, like, for example, difficulty breathing is not a checkbox that was on the Moderna vaccine.
Right.
Now, granted, I didn't feel like I was in any sort of danger when I was having difficulty breathing. It's something that is important to log because there are going to be other people out there that have that symptom.
Right.
And doctors and scientists need to be able to figure out what does that percentage look like.
Yeah.
Especially whether or not people may or may not have had COVID. So for me, where I had difficulty breathing, there's a lot of factors to consider. Number one, I'm pretty sure I had it, as I said before. I'm pretty sure I had COVID before we knew what COVID was. But number two, I'm also an asthmatic. So it could be that I had COVID. I got that after I got that second shot, I got the breathing issues, bam, breathing issues. But there could also be a bunch of people, more people out there. It's like, I never got COVID. I'm an asthmatic. I got breathing issues. So then doctors are going to be able to sit down and say, okay, if you're an asthmatic, there is an X percent chance that you might develop difficulty breathing.
Right.
Here's what our recommended path is. Here's what you need to be looking out for. And of course, if you feel like your life is in danger, call 911.
Right, right. I wonder how many people are underreporting or overreporting that giant penis syndrome. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm here to report it's massive.
Yeah.
Ha. I think it's hilarious to see. What nice pun there. I think it's hilarious to see some people like they're reporting all these kinds of fun things. Like, yeah, there's always going to be some people who mess with the data and everything, but
right.
that's also really valuable for us to know, because the percentage of people who actively like throw things in there is also a rough percentage of data that you can discount. Mm-hmm. And that's a really famous data experiment that was done on soldiers in Vietnam about trying to see what percentage of them were smoking marijuana that grows widely in the jungles of Vietnam. And the design was deliberately inclusive of a bunch of questions that they would just answer as yes naturally. Uh-huh. So that when, you know, they like, and you'd be able to discount the like bogus answers from it. So I think, so it was like, you had 100 cards, 50 of them had some questions like, is the sky blue? Or do you like candy? Or something like that, where you would definitely answer yes. So that, and you wouldn't, it was blinded so that people didn't know what mm-hmm. the question was. You just pick a card and answer yes or no. And so 50% of them would just say yes. Well, you discount 50% of the answers, which were yes, and then you get a true nature of the rest. So I think there's something also is like, when you have these bogus answers that people are putting into the VSafe system, that is a proportion that you can actually just subtract, because it's like, okay, well, 0.3% of the data is bogus because people are actively putting stuff in. So let's get rid of that. And that actually corrects for a lot of our data. Right. So I think it's kind of a cool thing to see, is that you can actually quantify the dumbass stuff as well as the smart stuff.
But I will say, as a non-scientist, I will endorse the policy that the vaccine increases the size of your penis, but getting COVID shrinks it immensely. And so you want to consider that but I'm not saying Dan is saying that. I'm saying Jason is saying that.
Here's the funny thing.
I do not endorse that statement.
No, Dan did not endorse that statement.
But here's a funny thing is that what they have discovered is that people who've gotten COVID are actually, there's actually a significant population that is getting erectile dysfunction after having COVID, because guess what? If you're not getting good oxygen flow, you're going to have a hard time getting it up. I know this is because, funny enough, so I have sleep apnea, and I developed some significant problems with being able to get it up. Mm. Well, when you have a low blood oxygen count and your body's struggling to survive, turns out getting it up isn't a priority for your body.
That's right.
So if you have COVID-related issues that turn into messing with your lungs, you're going to end up with issues being able to get it up. So that's actually something that has come up in the data, interestingly enough. So get your vaccine and make sure your pee-pee still works.
I will endorse that statement. I love that.
So one of the best things, I don't know if you can answer or attest to this, or just you have friends that can. One of the best things about this vaccine to me was, if there was a point when I learned that there was 110,000 hospital beds in the country and they were all full, plus some. And now I'm seeing that about 40,000 of those beds are full. And I think that is so amazing as a de-stressor to our hospital workers. And I don't know, Dan, if you know anybody that's on the front line in that way. Are they feeling it? Are they feeling the de-stress?
Well, I'm not necessarily on the front line, but my work is definitely in public health response. And I have had the privilege of working with a lot of long-term care facilities that were absolutely wrecked by COVID, not just in the spring, but especially in the winter, in like November, mm-hmm. late November and into December. And nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities and personal care homes were some of the first to get like mass vaccination out to the elderly residents, because they were the highest rate of death and by major outbreak were in those facilities. And it was just night and day. Like what we're seeing right now is facilities where there's high vaccine rates, there are still people getting COVID because they're not vaccinated. Most people who are getting COVID are not vaccinated, right. But you have one case that turns into maybe two cases that goes back down to zero over a couple weeks, as opposed to 1 to 2 to 4 to 15 to 60. Right. And so I don't think I can speak personally to the hospital side. The hospitalization rates are substantially down, mm-hmm. but it was really interesting to see not just overall like hospitalizations going down, but comparing anecdotally, admittedly, long-term care facilities with very good vaccination rates versus those that did not, the sizes of the outbreaks that they're still getting, the rates of hospitalizations and deaths that they're getting. It really is showing, I'm seeing firsthand the the vaccine. Well, not firsthand, secondhand. I'm seeing secondhand through these folks who work there. The vaccine is really doing its job very well. And yes, there are still some people who get sick, but the rate of hospitalization and rate of death is so low that we actually have the privilege of studying like individual deaths of people who died with the vaccine and then died from COVID, which is very, very rare. And so you can actually be like, okay, what actually happened? And these you know, government officials are going through death records because we have the privilege of doing that, as opposed to just being like, oh, another 50 deaths today.
Right. You
know? So it's a huge, and the vaccine has been a huge change of pace for our focus, because it has given us the privilege of being able to get off the, like, try to stop from drowning, and now we can like navigate the waters of like, okay, what are these data telling us overall? So that's my personal assessment.
I just love that it's taking that stress off of our frontline workers that way. You know, I hope they're getting some sleep.
Yeah,
a lot of them are still frustrated by the being vaccinated and, you know, still having to wear the mask and still having to do all the lockdowns and all the extra stuff. Like, it is stressful, but it's a different type of stress than like having 15 people on a ventilator and three staff members because the rest of the floor got COVID. Like, it's a different ball game, a different series of discussions having to happen.
How do you feel about still having to follow the protocols even though you've been vaccinated?
I think obviously it's a good idea, especially in like healthcare settings where, you know, that's masking and distancing and disinfecting is not just for COVID. It's standard infection prevention precautions in healthcare settings, right? So I see no issue with, you know, the idea of people still being trying to be really safe. And overwhelmingly when people do get COVID, and when COVID does spread in a facility, it's because of lapses in masking, distancing, disinfecting, and the standard stuff, right?
Right.
The COVID outbreaks are not a surprise anymore. We know what causes them in these facilities and in these settings. It's lapses in infection prevention. And just because you've been vaccinated, it substantially decreases the chance of you being able to spread COVID, but it doesn't guarantee that you cannot. And so when people start acting like it's a guarantee, that's when, you know, other lapses happen, and that's when things get risky. So from a public health perspective, I have no issue with it. I think it's just, you know, the fatigue of having to do the masking, distancing, weekly testing, all this other stuff. It's the fatigue is real, and I get it. It's hard. And
they were doing all that anyway. They were in the hospital form. They were doing that anyway. But I'm talking about movie theaters or baseball games or Like, at what point do we just have to? I'm trying to figure out: do we exclude people that don't want to get vaccinated? Do we show our vaccine card? Am I safe in a theater without a mask at some point because I'm vaccinated, knowing that somebody in the theater might not be vaccinated? These are the things people are really concerned about, and I don't know how we
get. So here's my hot take on this: the vaccine, especially the mRNA vaccines, we know that they protect you against COVID. You know, individually, they substantially reduce your risk of COVID.
Right.
I think it's a strategic move, and this is going to be taken by some folks being like, it's a conspiracy. Like, I think it's a strategic move by public health officials to say, let's keep the masks on even though you're vaccinated, and slowly roll back some of these protocols over time as more and more people get vaccinated. So, for example, if we came out and said, once the vaccine was available, hey, once you got the vaccine, you don't have to wear a mask or distance anymore.
Right.
Everyone would say, hey, I have the vaccine, and no one would get vaccinated, because there'd be no point.
Right.
So is it like, oh, it's all about control? Well, kind of, yeah. But that's a good thing, because if we just said, okay, screw it, you don't have to do anything anymore, and just make it really easy for you to lie about having a vaccine card, then you're not actually fulfilling the outcome. So the output is like number of vaccines. The output is the number of people who have to wear masks. The outcome is stopping people from getting COVID, right? And you have to think about the long term. If you have to enact policies that will prevent the spread of disease, and it's not just like, you know, just having the science, like there's the science of the science, and then there's the science of the policy, and they're not always the same thing. And it's challenging to be able to navigate both the policy and the scientific, like, world when it comes to it. So I think it's a good strategy for people to still, you know, have to wear masks when vaccinated in indoor spaces. I still think it's a good idea for people to continue doing social distancing, not just for COVID, but it's actually preventing a lot of other diseases.
Totally.
But I see that it's not as simple as like, hey, we're vaccinated now, so we can just go back to normal. It's like, no, we should embrace some of these changes and be more mindful about our health because of the pandemic and prevent more disease.
Okay. Yeah. And mathematically speaking, I mean, we're not at that point where we've had enough vaccine taken in order to really tamp down spread as it is. And one of the other things that we're still even looking at too is how asymptomatic people may spread the disease. I know that there's been more information on that, but it's still one of those things where it's like most of our response for the last, you know, year has been just like lock it down as hard as we can so that way we can try and get the hospital some breathing room until we get a vaccine. And even still, you know, one of the other issues and concerns that we have out there is variants and breakthrough cases because, you know, like we talked about, you know, nothing is 100% effective. So the question is what do we have to do to get as close to that number as we can? And I think one of the factors that even those of us who are vaccinated now have to take into effect is, you know, when variants come through, the effectiveness of the vaccine does drop. Mm-hmm. Does it drop to a point that leaves us in danger? The answer right now seems to be not really, but from a public health perspective and a mathematics perspective, at least, you know, we still want to get that number as low as possible.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so when you have Pfizer and Moderna working on boosters for variants that are currently the majority, and we can get those boosters into arms as well, mm-hmm. so that way we can stop the spread. And then it becomes a mathematical model of predicting what the next, you know, main variant is going to be, so that way we can tool up a response to that.
Or local. If there's a variant that's hot in Montana, you can create something for Montana as opposed to Illinois, who has a different variant.
You know, and that's going to be a little bit tougher unless you have a lot of facilities that are tooling up variants, and that's just not a thing, unfortunately.
Right.
But you do see cases take over mathematically a country, you know, places where there's more freedom of travel in between. So like here in the United States, we had the South African and the UK variant. Yeah. And I think it was, Dan, you can correct me, if it was the UK variant, I think is the one that became the dominant variant in the United States.
You're correct.
So, it, you know, being able to tool up a response to those variants, you know, and the South African variants, the ones that we see as problematic, like the ones that are clearly evading the protections of the vaccine, you know, are we going to see things get closer to normal? Absolutely. Should it be a slow rollback? Public health, I think, is going to have a better understanding of what that rollback looks like, especially as we get boosters produced and in arms. Do I think we're going to get closer to normal as the end of the year comes? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it all just depends on, number one, people's willingness to participate in the vaccination effort.
Of course.
Number two, how quickly we can get boosters out for the variants so that way we have even fewer breakthrough cases, especially like where Moderna is seeing an even greater production of antibodies with their boosters. So mm-hmm. that's going to be exciting to see, because if these are more effective and produce greater responses, that means that we're going to see even fewer breakthrough cases, and we can really limit this down as much as possible and start to address whatever else might come through, if at all, if we even need to at all. And the answer is yes, we probably will, but it's not going to look like how it has, mathematically speaking.
I have a booster question for Dan. Can we put multiple protections for multiple variants into one vaccine, like the flu shot we get?
In theory, yeah. Okay. In practice, we don't really know how that would work. Because we obviously hasn't been tried before, but if you're just looking at a purely theoretical situation, yeah, it could be. The challenge, though, it would be in vaccine production is like trying to make sure that you have a good mix. Like mm-hmm. you're trying to make basically these emulsions. I talked about really early on the show about like the lipids versus the mRNA and everything.
Yeah,
you need to be able to show that you could effectively package multiple mRNAs for multiple variants into the different lipid packages
right.
At a uniform enough like proportions so that you know, like, everyone's getting the right dosage. And that's a challenge, right? We'd have to see what happens, and I'm sure science would be able to figure out a way to do that, but it isn't possible in theory. But in practice, we don't really know how that would work, and we don't have any evidence. But that's something that we have.
Moderna's actually testing that. Moderna's actually testing that with their booster, because they're using the Brazil and the South African variant in their booster. And I believe it's like the sequence that they're trying to work on. And I think this is in both. It's the E484K, I believe it is, of specific sequence that they're working on targeting, that is present in both the Brazil and South African variants.
Nice.
Yeah, I can definitely see it working in theory. It's just like, how well will it do in practice? Because everything's perfect on a whiteboard. When it goes into someone's arms is a very different thing. That's the whole reason why pharma is such a challenging industry to be in. Like, you come up with amazing ideas, and the rate of failure is so high. So
right, Dan, you know what's really scaring me about all this? Measles and whooping cough is on the rise. I think we're ignoring some other things that are going on.
Yeah, I mean, there has been, we definitely need to think more than just about COVID, but that's one of the encouraging things about the mRNA platform of vaccines being developed, right? We can hopefully modernize and improve on vaccines that have been pretty much licensed for 50, 60, sometimes even more than 100 years, the same vaccine, right? Or a very similar vaccine. So there's ways that we can maybe update this, but also being mindful that, you know, in a one health approach, as we say, like, there's lots of different things that we need to be mindful of. And that's one of the really good things about masking, distancing, and washing our hands, right? You know, hand hygiene is the fundamental idea of infection prevention, right? If we are continuing to sanitize our hands and wash our hands and continue to distance, like, other diseases besides COVID are going to continue to be low. And that's actually something we've seen, is that a lot of other respiratory infections have been, like, we didn't have a flu season. We did not have a flu season, because flu is less transmissible than COVID, and whatever worked on COVID worked exceptionally way better on flu. Right. So, and it wasn't from lack of testing, because we were testing, maybe not as much as we were, but like, the rate of decline in flu testing relative to the rate of decline of positivity, like, it was definitely like flu was way down. So it's something for us to keep in mind, is that these practices in general are not just good things for COVID. It's good for, you know, disease Everything. Prevention in general. Yeah.
Right. So, and then, if I get the COVID vaccine and I need to go get my shingles vaccine, is there a time period I should wait? Should I talk to my doctor about that? Is it just okay to do?
Yes. So the current guidance, at least in Pennsylvania, I don't know about federally, but it's probably the same, is that you should not, if you get any immunization besides COVID vaccine, you should wait 14 days before getting your COVID shot. So if you get dose one, you should wait 14 days on either side. So make sure that you're planning that out with your doctor, and actually, like, when you go get your vaccines for COVID, they ask, like, have you gotten an immunization in the last 14 days? And the answer is yes, they will turn you away. And that's not necessarily because it's been proven with causality that these co-immunizations are severe. It's just, we want to be on the extra safe side.
Yeah. So let's keep our data clean.
Absolutely. Yep. Exactly.
Nice. Hey, Dan, why don't you, what was the last movie you watched? I like to end this with movie recommendations for some reason.
Oh, what was the last movie I watched? That's a good question.
Yeah.
Hang on, my wife is right here. I'll have to ask her. Hey, what was the last movie I watched?
Was it Outbreak?
We watched the Hobbit trilogy a few weeks ago. My wife did not really get into the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, so she's been very patiently, like, going along with me. So that's been the last, just trying to show her that we're reading the books together, and, like, being able to, like, it's a nice evening activity just to pull out the books and just read through and talk about it. And then it's like, okay, well, we finished this book. Let's watch the movie. That's what I've been doing, but it's been far too long since I've actually sat down and watched a movie, because it's been a little busy in the world of public health.
And it's not going to get by me. Congratulations on the wedding.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
You're Congratulations on defending your thesis too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I'm now Master of Science.
Welcome to the fold, Dan.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I'm happy
from
to
one
be
master
here,
of science to another.
Oh yes, we're master of science, but that does not make us better than anyone. We need to. No. We have a responsibility to share good science with everyone now.
In fact, one of the funniest things that we always said, you know, that our teachers always said to us, and that I have continued to, you know, teach my kids is that Master of Science doesn't mean that I'm smarter than anybody else. Usually it just means I know how to use Google better than most people.
Amen to that. That's literally my life. I Googled my way. That's fantastic, right? Google is an amazing resource. It's like a lot of, you know, it's not using Google really efficiently is a key skill, and you can learn it really well, but it can also lead you down some really bad paths into misinformation. Yep. So that's an important thing we should be teaching our kids, is like how to use search engines really effectively and how to fact check themselves and fact check sources.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We did that in episodes called Misunderstanding Misinformation, where we talked about links that you should be looking at, sources and all of that stuff. So people should check that out. How about you, Jeffrey? Any movie?
What was the last movie that I sat down and watched? I think the last movie I sat down and watched was Jurassic Park.
Oh, that's right. You said that last week. You don't count.
Yeah, I know. I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch any movies. I've actually just been watching anime with the kids. So, because I'm a nerd, I love anime, and I'm really enjoying My Hero Academia with the kids. It's a
good show. The new season just started, right?
Yes, it did.
All right. I just watched The Prophecy with Christopher Walken and Eric Stoltz. I couldn't go to sleep. Like, I put it on so I could go to sleep, and I watched it all the way through. And then I found out there's like four more. So
Christopher Walken's always a win.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Win. Did you want to say anything in wrapping up, Dan? Did we miss anything? Should we have covered something else?
Oh, no, we covered so much. It's been amazing to chat with you guys about all this really interesting stuff. And I'm just very happy to be able to come on and contribute to your guys' show. And I just want to tell everyone who's listening to, you know, keep on keeping on, you know, get the vaccine if you can, continue masking, washing your hands, social distancing, being a responsible public health citizen. You know,
for sure.
We talked a lot about so much, but that's really the same thing as always being mindful and being respectful of the fact that we are still in a pandemic and that we do have these unforeseen challenges, and we are not done with this just because the vaccine is out. So continue being responsible, continue showing respect for your fellow Americans or wherever you are in the world, and be that responsible public health citizen. So that's all I have to say. What about you, Jeffrey?
You know, you definitely hit the nail on the head. Is that, you know, I know that this is tough and trying and frustrating. I'm one of those people that I'm ready to be done with the damn mask as much as anybody else is. But the reality is that, you know, we're not out of the woods yet. And, you know, if there is any question about why that is, I say, look at what's happening in India, because there's always the chance that could be us again. Yeah. And, you know, be a good, a public health citizen to your friends, to your community, to your state, to your nation, to the world. Mm-hmm. You know, we are going to get there. It's going to take a little time. And right now, you know, like as it has been, time has been our enemy. The more shots we get in arms and the more that we can get out to the rest of the world, the sooner that we do get to go back to doing the things without the mask, the sooner that those quote unquote liberties that some have felt that have been sacrificed are going to be returned to us. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where the data is showing that what we're doing is working, especially as we get vaccines in arms. Yeah. So now it's let's keep this going. Let's get more vaccines in arms. Let's get boosters in arms. Let's get back to doing things that we love, like, you know, bratwurst at the ballpark during a summer game. We can get there, and we're getting there. You know, hold on, have faith. We'll do this.
Yeah, and use your common sense. If my governor says that you don't have to wear a mask, I say I'm going to wear a mask anyway in the grocery store. But I also am looking for other people that are fully vaccinated, so I don't have to sit at a party with my mask on. But if one person isn't vaccinated, I'm putting my mask on, because I believe that I shouldn't take my mask off till everybody can take their mask off.
And also too, just, you know, just to make sure that it's clear, it's, you know, at this point, like, especially if you've been vaccinated, it's not about the worry of getting the vaccine in. The mask has never been about protecting it from coming into you.
Right.
It's about protecting other people who aren't vaccinated from you spreading it to them.
Right.
That is still very much the case. So more vaccines in arms means less need for a mask.
That's right.
And it's for those who can't be vaccinated. And once we do hit that 70% threshold, I think we're going to see this get a lot better.
Yeah.
I'm very hopeful for that too.
Until the next one comes around.
But hopefully it won't be for a while, but hopefully we will have a lot of data that says that tells us what we did, what worked and what didn't.
Right now,
and when it comes back around, I'll be happy to join back on the podcast to talk about it.
Yay. I'm just thinking that right now, somewhere in the world, there's a little baby virus just saying, it's my turn. And we need to be careful about all that. We can't think that this is the end all and be all for the next 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
I love you guys. Thanks for being here.
Too.
Thanks. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
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 To those who would tear the world down, we will defeat you.
This is our moment.
This is our time. To those who seek peace and security, we support you.
Yes, we can.
And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we prove once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbow. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life.
Ask not.
Yes, we can.
What your country can do for you.
I have a dream.
Ask what you can do for your country.
I, poor little children.
Yes, we can.
One day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression.
In this lifetime, you don't have to prove nothing to nobody except yourself.
It ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward.
That's how winning is done.
Welcome to Public Access America.
Yes, we can.
Now on Instagram
and SoundCloud.
We wanted to run out of that tunnel for my dad.
On Twitter.
Apple Podcast, the Stitcher Smart Radio app,
Podable, and Spotify.
Yes, we can.
Public Access America. History in the making.
Making history.
In the making.